Hello, this is Lori, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Tuesday, December 2nd issue of the Canandaigua Daily Messenger on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Dry summer opens door for dam repairs. The dry season in 2025 that left much of western New York in drought conditions had one unexpected benefit. It provided an opportunity for some much-needed maintenance and upgrades at the base of Mount Morris Dam. The upstream conduits at its base, which allow the Genesee River to pass through, had been untouched since construction was completed on the dam nearly 70 years ago. The aged infrastructure needs maintenance, and the only way to do that work is through bulkheads to seal off the river. It's that time where we've got to get back in there and do some more heavy capital maintenance, said Steve Winslow, manager of the Mount Morris Dam. While Mount Morris Dam is considered a dry dam as it doesn't maintain a reservoir, it does hold back water as needed to keep river flow manageable as the Genesee River flows through communities downstream. The guides for the bulkheads were installed during the deep drought this summer. Large dirt berms were constructed to redirect the remaining flow of the Genesee River, while the steel rails were affixed to the surface of the concrete dam. The steel bulkheads with rubber gaskets come as two separate pieces, each 4,000 pounds, which are lifted into place and provide a watertight seal over the conduit they block. The bulkhead installation and fabrication cost about $720,000. Now, when we have a major project inside of one of these tunnelways, we can come down here in the summer when it's a period of dry weather like it is now, install that bulkhead and block that water flow from going off, Winslow said. And we just bought ourselves about however much time we need to work inside of that culvert in a dry situation. While the dirt berms, a cofferdam, were in place for work on the bulkhead guides, it awarded a unique opportunity to look at the conduits. It's the first time inspectors were able to access that part of the dam since its construction, a chance to review the concrete, steel, and gate components critical to the dam's operation. Other parts of the dam are able to be inspected on a routine basis. The good news is a lot of it is in very good shape, better than we anticipated, Winslow said. So that's going to help save some money in the future. Mount Morris Dam is considered a high hazard dam due to the people and infrastructure downstream, including the city of Rochester. Routine maintenance by the Army Corps of Engineers is happening all the time, but preventative maintenance and more investment will be needed as components of the structure age. The concrete is in good shape. A lot of the interior components are in good shape, but they're older, Winslow said. So things that were made out of steel and installed in the 50s, we've got corrosion issues, we have some damage from weathering and erosion. The installation of the bulkhead guides was planned for about 5 years, including design and funding allocation. When conditions dried out this summer, it became a perfect opportunity to move ahead on work from July through September. What are the chances we wouldn't have rain during that period, Winslow said. If we had about a 1-inch rainstorm, that would have overtopped our cofferdam, believe it or not, and then that would have interrupted this work and kicked it into the future. Eastview Mall adds baby goat hangout. If you're shopping at Eastview Mall and need a break, now you can hug a baby goat. Kazan Ridge Farm has opened Happy Goat Hangout at Eastview in an 8,000-square-foot space next to the closed Lord & Taylor. We have so many sweet little babies right now that we just decided to share them with everybody, said farm owner Allison Sherman. We're going to do some goat snuggling time. You can snuggle or play, and we're going to do goat yoga. Baby goat snuggling hours are 3 to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday and 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. Sherman transports the animals daily to and from Eastview, about a 10-minute drive from her farm, in a van. About 15 baby goats are there on weekdays and as many as 30 in two shifts on weekends. Admission is $20 for ages 6 and older, free for children 5 and younger, with a paid adult. $60 for a family of five. Goat yoga classes are being offered at 10 a.m. Tuesdays and 11:30 a.m. on Saturdays. The cost is $30. The attraction opened November 23rd. We had over 100 people come through, and we're expecting a lot this weekend, Sherman said, referring to the official start of the holiday shopping season. Speaking of which, the business is selling $20 gift certificates that can be used toward open goat playtime or goat yoga. They also will be redeemable at the farm, which is at 1675 Brace Road in Victor, when it reopens for events in the spring. For more, go to the farm's Facebook page. Happy Goat Hangout at Eastview will run through the end of January, Sherman said. Because goats are known to relieve themselves wherever and whenever, Sherman has employees assigned to each pen set up in the space, and their only job is to clean up after the animals. They keep it very clean, she said. There's no smell. The poop's easy to sweep up. Key weather patterns point to blizzard risk in New York. While most forecasts point to a milder winter across the U.S., if the right weather permits a line, pockets of heavy snow or even a blizzard could still make a comeback to New York. Fittingly, the Old Farmer's Almanac named its 2025-26 winter forecast mostly mild with pockets of wild. For New York, it predicts mild and dry conditions for upstate and western regions, with cold and dry weather in central New York. Milder and drier, with most snow falling around the holidays and late winter. Fewer snow days could ease commutes, but not as we get ready to usher in 2026, the Almanac wrote. The Climate Prediction Center offers a similar outlook. Its latest forecast shows above normal chances for warmer than average temperatures in New York through January, with equal chances for below normal, average, or above normal precipitation. Despite the generally mild outlook, meteorologists are watching key atmospheric factors that could create bursts of intense snow, like expected next week when an early season lake effect snow is expected to impact the Great Lakes. If everything lines up, New Yorkers may see their first major snow event of the season weeks ahead of schedule. Even though much of New York is expected to see a relatively mild winter, several key atmospheric traits are already in place that could support brief bursts of heavy snow and extreme cold. While none of these factors alone guarantee extreme weather, if they line up at the right time, they could create the perfect conditions for a major winter storm. La Niña has officially developed and is expected to persist through winter before easing back to ENSO neutral in early spring. In the northeast, La Niña typically shifts the jet stream northward, allowing colder than average air to settle over upstate New York. However, this La Niña is relatively weak, so on its own it may not produce extreme conditions. Still, it tends to leave the Great Lakes partially unfrozen longer into the winter, providing a ready source of moisture for lake effect snow. But easterly phase of the quasi-biennial oscillation adds another layer of complexity. It can weaken the polar vortex, a fast-moving circulation of winds that normally keeps Arctic air confined to the North Pole. The QBO is a stratospheric wind pattern roughly 10 to 30 miles above the Earth's surface that oscillates between easterly and westerly phases every 28 to 29 months. When the QBO is easterly, as it recently shifted, it makes the vortex less stable and more prone to wobbles, essentially creating gaps in the circulation and allowing frigid Arctic air to push south. If this cold air meets the open waters of the Great Lakes, kept unfrozen longer by La Niña, it can amplify lake effect snow, producing heavier, more localized snowfalls. La Niña sets the stage by keeping moisture available, while the easterly QBO can trigger a wobbling polar vortex that pushes Arctic cold southward. It's the combination of these traits, moisture, cold air, and the timing of their interaction that creates the potential for a major winter storm or blizzard. Lake effect snow typically happens when cold, dry Arctic air moves over a large, relatively warm lake, creating narrow bands of clouds that can dump snow anywhere from a few minutes to several days. This week's air is actually coming straight from Canada, but it's cold enough to create a slight risk for lake effect snow, especially if winds line up just right. Wind direction also matters a lot. It can mean heavy snow in one town, while a sunny mile or two away sees nothing. Westerly winds. These are most common for Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse. When cold air moves from the west over Lakes Erie and Ontario, it picks up moisture and heat from the water. As that air reaches land, the moisture condenses and falls as heavy, localized snow. Northwesterly winds. These can enhance snow totals in western New York, including the Tug Hill Plateau east of Lake Ontario. La Niña, Spanish for the girl, happens when the surface waters of the central and eastern Pacific Ocean are colder than normal for several months in a row, according to the National Weather Service. It's part of a natural climate pattern called the El Niño Southern Oscillation, which flips back and forth every few years between La Niña, cooler waters, and El Niño, warmer waters. These shifts in ocean temperatures may seem small, but they can nudge the jet stream and change weather patterns all over the world. While its counterpart, El Niño, the boy, often brings milder winters to the northern U.S., La Niña tends to set the stage for colder snaps and more volatile conditions there. When ocean temperatures in the central and eastern Pacific are close to average, not unusually warm like El Niño or unusually cold like La Niña, scientists call it ENSO neutral. Neutral conditions mean the Pacific isn't giving the atmosphere a strong push one way or the other. So seasonal weather patterns are more likely to be shaped by other factors like the Arctic or Atlantic oceans. Rochester's keg tree tops national list, tops Rockefeller's tree. Step aside Rockefeller Center Christmas tree. It's time for another Christmas tree to shine, and it's made from empty beer kegs. Yes, sitting atop this year's Newsweek Best Christmas Tree list like a bright, shining Genesee beer sign is the Genesee Brewhouse keg tree. It was chosen by Newsweek readers from a list of finalists selected by our expert panelists and contributors, the magazine states. All we can say is, well done, readers. The Rockefeller Center tree, a tradition since 1933, and the nation's most famous holiday beacon, according to Newsweek, came in fifth. This despite its 50,000 glowing LED lights and a 900-pound Swarovski crystal star. The entire list reads as follows. Number one, the Genesee Brewery keg tree. Number two, Congress Hall tree in Cape May, New Jersey. Number three, the Galleria Dallas tree in Dallas. Number four, Fairmont Scottsdale Princess tree in Scottsdale, Arizona. Number five, Rockefeller Center tree in New York City. Number six, Dallas Arboretum tree in Dallas. Number seven, the National Christmas Tree in Washington, D.C., which is also tied with the Philadelphia City Tree in Philadelphia. Number eight, the Biltmore Estate Tree in Asheville, North Carolina. And number nine is Faneuil Hall Marketplace Tree in Boston. The runners-up include the Capitol Holiday Tree in Madison, Wisconsin, the Grove Tree in Los Angeles, California, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Tree in Monterey, California, the Newport Mansions Tree in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Royal Hawaiian Tree in Honolulu. This year's free keg tree lighting event starts at 5 p.m. December 5th at the Brew House, 25 Cataract Street, and will continue through 9 p.m. The switch will be flipped on the tree, built from 650 empty beer kegs and wrapped in 25,000 twinkling lights at 7 p.m. Dean Jones, Brew House Brewmaster, will serve as Master of Ceremonies and count down to the lighting, which will be accompanied by popular holiday tunes animated on a lighted board. New this year is Genesee's debut of Keg Tree Donuts, a festive collaboration with another Rochester institution, Donuts Delight. The special treats, honey bun donuts infused with Genesee Brewery's Keg Tree Cinnamon Ale, are available through December 5th at the Brew House and Donuts Delight, 1700 Culver Road. They also will be sold at the Keg Tree Lighting, and a portion of the proceeds will benefit the Breast Cancer Coalition. The Keg Tree debuted in 2014 and was an instant hit. The first one was made from 300 empty half-barrel kegs trimmed with 600 feet of LED green rope lights. Capped with a rotating Genesee beer sign, the tree stood 23 feet tall, reaching the second-story brewhouse balcony. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Canandaigua Daily Messenger on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. When and how to watch Rockefeller Center Christmas tree lighting? The 2025 lighting of the 75-foot-tall Rockefeller Center Christmas tree is set for Wednesday, December 3rd. The event is from 7 to 10 p.m. at 30 Rockefeller Plaza in Midtown Manhattan. The Christmas in Rockefeller Center special will air live on NBC at 8 p.m. Eastern U.S. time and stream on both NBC and Peacock, the network's website said. Country music star Reba McEntire, who can be seen on Happy's Place and The Voice, will host and perform on the special. NBC said other performers include musical guest Mark Anthony, Halle Bailey, Michael Bublé, Kristen Chenoweth, Lofi, New Edition, Brad Paisley, Carly Pierce, the Radio City Rockettes, and Gwen Stefani. The Rockettes celebrate their 100th anniversary this year, are also slated to perform. And what about the lights? Well, there are more than 50,000 multicolored LED lights on about 5 miles of wire on the tree, Rockefeller Center's website said. The star topping the tree was designed by architect Daniel Libeskind in 2018. It's a three-dimensional Swarovski star that weighs in at about 900 pounds. It has 70 spikes covered in 3 million crystals. The tree, about 75 years old, is 45 feet in diameter and approximately 11 tons, the website said. It is a Norway spruce from East Greenbush in New York's Rensselaer County. A journey of about 130 miles brought the tree to Manhattan after the tree was cut on November 6th. The tree will be on display until mid-January. The idea of a tree at Rockefeller Center dates to 1931, when Rockefeller Center workers pooled their money to buy a Christmas tree, a 20-foot-high balsam fir with handmade garlands made by their families. In 1933, Rockefeller Center decided to make it a yearly tradition and held the first tree lighting ceremony. Rockefeller Center's is not the only tree lighting in the Big Apple. The lighting of the 45-foot Bryant Park tree, also in Midtown, is set for the day before, Tuesday, December 2nd, according to the Bryant Park website. Festivities are scheduled to get underway at 5:30 p.m. World-class skaters are expected to perform. Olympian and U.S. champion Mariah Bell, U.S. Olympic team members and bronze medalist partners Caitlin Hayek and Jean-Luc Baker, Canadian national champion Kaya Reuter, and U.S. Olympic team member Emmanuel Saveri. Holiday music sing-alongs and fireworks are also on tap. Actor and chef David Burka will host the Bryant Park event. Western Northwestern University will pay $75 million to restore funding. Northwestern University has agreed to pay $75 million in a settlement with the Trump administration to restore hundreds of millions in federal funding that was withheld amid an investigation into alleged civil rights violations and anti-Semitism on campus. The settlement, announced November 28th, will reinstate nearly $800 million in federal funding that was frozen in April as the administration cracked down on universities, including Northwestern, Cornell, and others. The funding freeze came after the Trump administration and Republican lawmakers scrutinized college campuses for their handling of protests over the Israeli-Hamas war last year. The agreement dictates that the Chicago area school will pay $75 million to the U.S. Treasury Department over 3 years, according to news releases from the Justice Department and the school. It also puts an end to the investigations into complaints over the school's admissions, policies on transgender students, and handling of alleged anti-Semitism on campus. The federal funding should be fully restored within 30 days, interim Northwestern President Henry Bienen said, adding that the agreement ends a deeply painful and disruptive period in our university's history. Bienen, who took over as interim president after Michael Schill resigned the post in September, entered the stage during a politically fraught period of Northwestern's history. The payment to the government is not an admission of guilt, he said. Today's settlement marks another victory in the Trump administration's fight to ensure that American educational institutions protect Jewish students and put merit first, Attorney General Pam Bondi said in a statement. Bienen said Northwestern maintains control over whom it hires, whom it accepts as students, and what its faculty teaches. As part of the settlement, Northwestern will create a committee to ensure compliance with the terms, comply with federal anti-discrimination laws, which Bienen noted it already did, and terminate an agreement reached with protesters last year. The university said its recent policies enacted to support Jewish students will continue under the terms of the settlement. The settlement also requires Northwestern to adhere to Title IX policies by providing safe and fair opportunities for women, including single-sex housing for any woman defined on the basis of sex who requests such accommodations, and all-female sports, locker rooms, and showering facilities. It does not impose new restrictions on transgender members of the school community, Northwestern said. Earlier this month, Cornell University, also targeted with federal funding freeze, agreed to pay $30 million to the government and invest an equal amount into agricultural research to restore $250 million in frozen grant money. In October, the administration offered 9 universities preferential consideration for federal funding in exchange for agreeing to a set of policies. Deferred interest can result in hefty price tag. Now, amid the holiday season, one personal finance site is sounding the alarm on a ubiquitous retail payment plan that many Americans say should be outlawed. It's called deferred interest. In a typical scenario, the shopper puts a big purchase on a store credit card. The retailer promises to charge no interest if the buyer pays off the balance within a set time frame. The problem starts if users fail to repay the entire sum before the promotional clock runs out. At that point, the deal is off, and the consumer owes every penny of deferred interest, often at a steep annual rate of 30% or more. It's as if the promotion never existed. Roughly half of American consumers don't fully understand how deferred interest works, Wallet Hub reported in a study published November 17th. There's a lot of fine print with these deferred interest offers, said Ted Rosman, a senior industry analyst at Bankrate, a site that also studies deferred interest. Sometimes people don't even realize what they're signing up for. Many consumers who do understand deferred interest think it is unfair. In the Wallet Hub study, 51% of consumers said it should be illegal. The report examined financing options at 72 large retailers and analyzed a nationally representative survey of 200 consumers. Some retailers downplay high interest rates in deferred interest plans, according to WalletHub, by printing them in tiny type or not displaying them prominently in loan documents. Deferred interest deals abound during the holidays, often under such banners as no interest for 12 months or same as cash, but those pitches are misleading, according to WalletHub, because the interest is still piling up. If you miss that payment by one day or one penny, all of that interest retroactively applies from the date of purchase, said Chip Lupo, a writer and analyst at WalletHub. Imagine someone buying a new refrigerator for $1,800 using a deferred interest offer of no interest for 24 months at an annual percentage rate of 25.99%. If they manage to pay $75 a month for each of those 24 months, they should be able to repay the full balance and avoid the interest. If they miss a payment or two, however, they will face an extra $900 or so in interest charges when the 24 months are up. The calculations come from Bankrate, which supplied the sample. Consumers spent more than $60 billion on deferred interest purchases in 2020, according to a report from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, findings that apparently have not been updated. The largest share went to home improvement. About four-fifths of consumers who used deferred interest paid off the debt by the end of the promotional period, thereby avoiding the interest, according to the federal agency. For savvy borrowers with good credit and sufficient disposable income, deferred interest can be a useful consumer tool, finance experts say. The advantage is the opportunity to spread out your cash flow and avoid interest payments on your purchases, especially big ones, Rosman said. It is illegal to be on your phone at a red light in New York. You're stopped at a red traffic light and your phone pings. You instantly move to pick up the phone and check the text or alert, but doing so is illegal according to New York's distracted driving laws. Sure, most folks know it's illegal to handle your phone while driving, but what about when your vehicle is stopped in a traffic or at a stoplight? Legally distracted driving is any activity that diverts attention from driving, according to the New York's Department of Motor Vehicles. It is defined as anything that takes your focus away from the task of safe driving and includes use of your phone via call or text, eating, and even fiddling with your vehicle's navigation or stereo system while on the move. Texting is the most alarming distraction, according to the agency. Sending or reading a text takes your eyes off the road for 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's like driving the length of an entire football field with your eyes closed. The National Safety Council reports that, on average, 9 people are killed each day in distracted driving crashes. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration found that amounted to 3,275 deaths in 2023. The high stakes have been established for some time. In New York, distracted driving is the most common contributing factor in all crashes. 1 out of every 5 in the state can be attributed to inattentive drivers, according to New York's Governor's Traffic Safety Committee. Still, several traffic safety groups advise if you need to read a text or to make a call, it's best to pull over safely and do so while fully parked, rather than doing so while stopped in traffic. You cannot drive safely unless the task of driving has your full attention, according to the Governor's Traffic Safety Committee. The agency offered 3 types of distraction: visual, taking your eyes off the road; manual, taking your hands off the wheel; cognitive, taking your mind off driving. Under state law, a driver cannot use a handheld mobile device, phone, or other portable electronic device while you drive. This includes talking on a handheld mobile phone, composing, sending, reading, accessing, browsing, transmitting, saving, or retrieving electronic data such as email, text messages, or web pages. viewing, talking, or transmitting images, playing games. Can you use your phone at a red light in New York? In short, no. Per state law, you cannot hold your phone in your hands while on the road, no matter whether your vehicle is moving or stopped in traffic. Officers will assume you are actively using it, whether you are or not. Can you talk on a cell phone while driving in New York? Yes, but only if it's hands-free. This means you can use voice-activated calling, speakerphone, or Bluetooth through your car's audio system as long as you're not using your hands or are distracted from driving. True emergencies do get a pass. You can call 911 or to contact medical, fire, or police personnel in the case of an emergency, even while driving. A first offense for a ticket for cell phone use is a violation with a fine that ranges from $50 to $250 and 5 points on your driving record, according to the DMV. A second violation within 18 months can increase the total fine up to $250, and a third violation or more in 18 months could impose up to a $450 fine per incident. Points on your record can lead to increased insurance costs or other penalties, including suspension of your license. Using a handheld device while driving has been illegal in the Empire State for more than two decades, as it was the first state in the nation to ban handheld phone use while driving in 2001. Texting while driving was officially banned by law in New York 8 years later. Nationally, more than 30 states, including New York, launched a no-touch law, which bans physically handling or touching a handheld phone or other electronic device while driving. In New York, it strengthened the existing law with stricter guidelines. Planning a holiday family gathering? The holidays bring family traditions such as gathering together to enjoy opening presents with your loved ones around the Christmas tree. To ensure this holiday season is healthy for you and your family, here are some tips to consider during the season. One of the most important tips to keep in mind before making holiday visits is making sure your vaccinations are up to date. Michael Apostopoulos, Chief Medical Officer of University of Rochester Medical Center, said anyone 6 months or older should get the flu vaccine. We're expecting a moderate to severe flu season, and the vaccination is the best method to prevent the flu, or if you get the flu, it will reduce the severity and your risk of getting admitted to the hospital, he said. Aside from vaccinations, people should wash their hands often to prevent the spread of a virus, as well as covering their mouth when coughing or sneezing. If you're not feeling well, the best thing to do for yourself and others is to avoid going out to friends or family and stay home and get the proper rest to get better. Apollopoulos also mentioned how the holidays are a time when people tend to put on weight. We ask people to make healthier food choices, like choosing fresh vegetables and fruits over fried foods, Apollopoulos said. If you're going out to a party, it's probably best to eat at home before you go. That way you avoid overeating, and we always recommend alcohol in moderation. In addition to physical health, emotional health is just as important. If putting together family gatherings feel overwhelming, don't be afraid to ask for help from family or friends to lighten the load. Practicing self-care rituals such as going for a walk or listening to music before or after an event can also help reduce stress. A tip for people who don't have family to be around for the holidays, spending it with friends can be another option, or you can volunteer at your local food bank, shelter, or soup kitchen to help others in need during the holiday season. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Canandaigua Daily Messenger on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Hurricane season was one of contrasts. The 2025 Atlantic hurricane season that ended November 30th was one for the record books, but maybe not in the way anyone expected when it began June 1st. For the first time in a decade, no hurricane made landfall in the United States, a welcome respite to beleaguered communities across the Southeast still recovering from earlier storms. But that didn't mean it was a quiet season overall. The season, with striking contrasts, ultimately is ending pretty much within the ranges predicted by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, except for fewer hurricanes overall than seasonal outlooks suggested. Hurricane scientist Brian McNulty summed it up as a slightly above average season with some strange characteristics. The number of Category 5 storms was one of the most striking of those characteristics. Usually, only a small fraction of hurricanes ever become a Category 5. This year, 23% of the named storms reached that status, with winds of 157 miles per hour or more, often rapidly intensifying in warm ocean waters. In the mainland United States, Tropical Storm Chantel made landfall near Litchfield, South Carolina on July 6th, and moved over North Carolina and Virginia. Its flooding rains were blamed for at least 6 deaths. The effects from hurricanes far offshore in the Atlantic, combined with other storms and seasonal high tides, pummeled beaches, especially along North Carolina's Outer Banks, where 16 houses collapsed between September 16th and October 28th. Jamaica and other islands in the Caribbean faced terrifying Hurricane Melissa in late October, which claimed at least 90 lives as it rapidly intensified and moved across Jamaica and Cuba and through the Bahamas. The hurricane, with sustained winds of 185 miles per hour at its center, caused massive destruction across western Jamaica. NOAA had forecast a 60% chance of an above-average season with 13 to 19 named storms in the Atlantic basin. It predicted 6 to 10 hurricanes and 3 to 5 major hurricanes. The season wound up with 13 named storms and 5 hurricanes, but 4 major hurricanes with winds of 111 miles per hour or more. That's one less named storm and 2 fewer hurricanes than average, but 1 more major hurricane than average and slightly more than average overall cyclone energy. Still, the conversation persists about how quiet the season was in the United States, considering the buzz at the beginning. After years in the National Weather Service in Florida, Brian Lamar got used to people questioning why it seemed like a quiet season when a busy season was forecast, even if their area was just barely missed by a major storm or when the Caribbean was getting repeated landfalls. Lamar, founder of Inspire Weather, said that even when a storm damages areas just a few miles away, if it doesn't happen in their neighborhood, people tend to think of it as a miss. "I always respond that something we should all be thankful for," he said. "That is certainly true in 2025. If not for a persistent East Coast trough, this season's storms would have either been coming into the Gulf or the southeastern United States," he said. The trough created anomalous counterclockwise steering winds around it, McNulty said. That effectively directed approaching hurricanes northward well before they had a chance to reach the U.S. Lamar describes meteorology and human forecasting as trying to forecast a twig moving in a river. Within that river, there are large rocks that change the course and create circulations and mini eddies in the water, he said. That's essentially what happens in the atmosphere, and the rocks are high pressure systems. Such subtle nuances are not predictable when the hurricane season forecasts arrive, he said. They are short-term weather factors that fine-tune the season forecasts. Many factors make the 2025 Atlantic season stand out, Lamar said. Among them, people now know about the Fujiwara effect is, he said. The meteorological phenomenon occurs when two vortices, such as tropical cyclones, approach each other, then tend to orbit a common center point. Imelda and Humberto came within 465 miles of each other and started spinning around each other. Hurricane Melissa matched, set, or nearly set several records, including within Aaron and Humberto, the season produced the second most Category 5 storms in the era of modern records, behind only 2005, which produced 4. Melissa tied the record for lowest central pressure at landfall. The only other storm with such low pressure at landfall was a Labor Day hurricane of 1935 in the Florida Keys. August measured about 700 feet above the ocean in Melissa's eyewall just before landfall in Jamaica. 252 miles per hour was the highest ever recorded by Dropsonde, an instrument dropped from a Hurricane Hunter aircraft to measure the storm's environment. Melissa's strongest sustained winds reached 185 miles per hour, tying several other Atlantic hurricanes and trailing only 1980s Allen for the strongest Atlantic storm on record. The team at Colorado State University, which pioneered the seasonal hurricane forecast, listed the following key points of the season, which ultimately produced fewer storms than the team initially projected in April. The accumulated cyclone energy, an index used by NOAA to describe overall hurricane activity, was 133, above 108% of average. Of the past 10 seasons, 9 had been either above normal or extremely active. This season wound up with more major hurricanes and more major hurricane days than average. No-name storms formed in the Atlantic from August 24th to September 16th. The last time there were no known storms in that same period was 1992. Before that, the last time was 1939. Concluding Colorado State's forecast was a reminder that only 5 months remain until the team's first forecast for the 2026 Atlantic hurricane season, planned for April 9th. Poll. More Americans say Trump has raised prices. A new poll found that more Americans are unhappy with President Donald Trump's stances on the economy and cost of living, with almost twice as many saying the president has helped raise prices rather than lowering them. In a Yahoo YouGov poll conducted November 21st to the 24th, 49% of respondents said Trump's actions since taking office for his second term in January have raised prices instead of cutting them. That's a nearly 2-to-1 ratio to the 24% who said he's done more to lower costs. The survey also found more Americans, 38%, now blame Trump more for inflation than his predecessor, former President Joe Biden, 31%, despite the now president campaigning on the economy during his successful 2024 presidential bid. The survey of 1,684 U.S. adults has a margin of error of plus or minus 3 percentage points. Trump's approval rating in the poll was at 40%, with 56% disapproving. That aligns with other recent surveys measuring how Americans view his job performance. In a New York Times daily polling average on November 30th, Trump had a 41% approval rating and a 56% disapproval rating. Real Clear Politics November 30 average is similar at a 42% approval and 55% disapproval. Among four key issues included in the Yahoo YouGov survey, the largest number of respondents disapproved of the president's handling of cost of living, with 63% disapproving and 31% approving. That was followed by the economy at 58% disapproving. Additionally, 60% of Americans in the survey said inflation is getting worse, rivaling the highest levels of discontent on the issue during the last 2 years of Biden's presidency. 17% said inflation is getting better. While inflation is down from COVID-era spikes, figures climbed in September in the most recent report. Consumer prices increased 3% in September from a year earlier, slightly up from 2.9% in August, according to the Labor Department's Consumer Price Index, a measure of goods and services costs across the country. Consumer sentiment, which measures how Americans are feeling about costs, also took a dive heading into the holiday season. The University of Michigan surveys of consumers on November 21st said its consumer sentiment index stands at 51, hovering near its record low of 50 in June of 2022. In the new polling, over three quarters of respondents, 79%, said they feel they are paying more for the same goods and services compared to a few years ago. 72% rated the state of the American economy as either fair or poor. A majority at 53% think the economy is getting worse. One of Trump's signature policy moves in his first year, The implementation of far-reaching import tariffs also scored low in the survey. Tariffs have done more harm than good to the economy in the short and long term, according to many of the survey respondents. 52% said they've done more immediate harm, and 43% said they've had longer-term negative effects. In sports, three things that stood out in Bills' victory in Pittsburgh. The play began innocently enough as the Buffalo Bills struggling to get anything going on offense after being shut out for the first 27 minutes faced a 2nd-and-3 at the Pittsburgh Steelers' 27-yard line. The Bills were trailing 7-0 but were finally starting to move the ball on their fifth possession Sunday night at Acrisure Stadium where Josh Allen dropped back to pass. When no one came open, a theme that continues to plague the passing game, he was forced to scramble to the right, but he had to slide short of the first down marker because Steelers linebacker Patrick Queen was closing in fast. Allen went to the ground, but Queen kept coming, and he smashed into Allen, which should have been the easiest penalty call of the night. Instead, there was no yellow laundry on the field, and the livid Bills began pushing and shoving with any Steeler they could find, fighting for their quarterback, who took an unnecessary shot. While the Bills ended up getting only a field goal on that possession, that felt like a defining moment in the game because it seemed to wake them from their slumber, and when they came back out for the second half, they were a different team and they went on to blow the Steelers out of their own stadium, 26-7. Yep, maybe a little bit, Allen said when asked if that hit ramped up the motivation. Moving forward, probably don't need that to get us going, need to find a way to get going by ourselves. Hey, whatever works, right? At that point in the game, the Bills needed a pick-me-up, and Queen, who perhaps somewhat karmically got hurt on the next play and was done for the game, provided it with his cheap shot. We try to keep 17 as clean as possible, and then when somebody goes out and does a cheap shot like that, you know, it kind of wakes everybody up to know. And we got to set our jaws, and we got to come out here and get ready to swing. It's going to be a Mike Tyson fight, offensive lineman Alec Anderson said. Coach Sean McDermott was proud of the reaction and said, "You put a hit like that on our quarterback? Yeah, the sideline is going to erupt. The team is going to back our quarterback like any player. That's what I expected to see, and that's what they did, and it was what it was." Was this a must-win for the Bills? No, we're not there yet. But had they lost, they would have slipped to the other side of the demarcation line in the AFC playoff race because Houston knocked off Indianapolis and the Texans would have flipped positions with Buffalo. Now the Bills, Colts, and Chargers all are sitting at 8-4 and holding the three wild card positions, and they stayed ahead of the surging Texans who are 7-5. Also, Buffalo holds head-to-head tiebreakers over three teams they could be battling at the end of the year: the Steelers, the Chiefs, and the Ravens. "Yeah, it's super important," Allen said. "Sitting at 8-4, understanding where we're at in our division and the conference for that matter, got to continue to find ways to win football games and feel like the four losses that we've had, a big part of that has been turnovers. Again, just making sure that we're better in that and understanding when we can protect the ball and move the ball and not hurt ourselves. We can be a really, really good team. Here are a few of my observations. Defense produced the game-changing sequence." While the hit on Allen snapped the Bills back into focus, it did not erase a pretty ugly first half when they left the field trailing 7-3. But Buffalo's much-maligned defense made two game-changing plays in the first 2 minutes of the third quarter, which resulted in two touchdowns. First, Joey Bosa strip-sacked Aaron Rodgers on the first play of the quarter, and Christian Benford scooped it and ran 17 yards for a touchdown. A few snaps after the kickoff, backup quarterback Mason Rudolph, who replaced an injured Rodgers for that one series, was picked off by Benford at the Buffalo 44, and Allen directed a 56-yard drive that ended with his 1-yard TD pass to Keon Coleman on 4th-and-goal that made it 16-7. There were still 21 minutes to play, but the game was essentially over. Needed it. That was a huge play, McDermott said of the Bosa-Benford dagger. He said it was important for the Bills to get points at the end of the first half, and what he was hoping for to start the second half was a three and out so the offense could get back to work. We turned the takeaway there and scored on defense, and then on the ensuing drive after that, took it away again and gave our offense a good field position, McDermott said. Number two, the running game was magnificent. How remarkable was Buffalo's 249-yard explosion on the ground? It was the most rushing yards allowed to an opposing team in Pittsburgh since the Bills rushed for 310 yards on September 28, 1975 at Three Rivers Stadium, a day in which O.J. Simpson ran for 227 yards and the Bills upset the defending Super Bowl champion Steelers. By the end of the third quarter, the Bills had 218 yards rushing, the most through three quarters against the Steelers since Seattle had 229 in a game it played in 1993. We'll have to watch the film, but it was an ass-kicking in all areas, Steelers edge rusher T.J. Watt said of the Bills' third 200-yard rushing game this season. James Cook led the way with a career-high 32 carries, and he finished with 144 yards, while Ray Davis chipped in with 62, Allen had 38, and Ty Johnson 5. And what was so impressive is that the Bills had this success playing without their starting offensive tackles, Deion Dawkins and Spencer Brown, as Alec Anderson and Ryan Vandermark stepped in and excelled. "I'm just so proud of the guys," guard David Edwards said. "Jomo ran his ass off, so did Ty, Ray, Josh. Full team effort, but a lot of credit has got to go to Alec and Vandy for how they played. I feel like the plan that we had from the coaches this week breathed a lot of life into Alec and Vandy, and a lot of credit's got to go to those guys. We had guys that believed in the plan and cared about it, and then we had coaches that trusted us to bring it to life. And so I think that all of that coming to fruition is the result that you saw tonight." Number three, Christian Benford played like an all-pro. Benford traveled with Pittsburgh's top receiver, DK Metcalf, the entire game, and he held him to three catches for 32 yards. Metcalf is an imposing specimen at 6'4" and 230 pounds, but the 6'1", 205-pound Benford never let Metcalf make a big play. Benford's season got off to a bit of a rocky start, but in the last few games, he has become the lockdown corner that he was in 2024. He has been traveling with the top receivers more and more, and this was one of his best performances of his career. On his fumble return touchdown, the first score of his career, he was just in the right place at the right time, though he showed good hands to scoop the ball cleanly before running 17 yards to the end zone. On his interception, he made the catch right along the sideline, doing a wide receiver-like toe tap to stay in bounds. "The message today was score on defense," linebacker Shaq Thompson said, and we responded to that. "It was big, right? I don't know who made the play, Joey or somebody forced the fumble, and CB picked it up and scored." The Bills report card. Running back Cook, reserve O-lineman, bully Steelers. If there's one thing you can count on from Pittsburgh Steelers head coach Mike Tomlin, it's that win or lose, he'll give you an honest assessment after every game. The man is not big on cliches or small talk. He gets right to the point, and Sunday night, in the wake of a 26-7 beatdown at the hands of the Buffalo Bills, Tomlin did not mince words. "Not a lot needs to be said. That's an awful performance by us," Tomlin said. "We didn't do a lot well tonight, obviously. We didn't possess the ball or maintain ball security and on offense. We were highly penalized. We allowed those guys to run the ball. Didn't play 60 minutes of action. Didn't play complimentary football. So we've got to absorb that result." A couple hundred feet away in the Buffalo locker room, Sean McDermott had an entirely different feeling after watching his team dominate the Steelers in a game he knew that Bills had to give, given their tenuous playoff position. "A great effort," McDermott said. "Certainly things we can work on, but good to come on the road and show our toughness. Here's how I graded the Bills. Pass offense is a D." This is probably a little harsh because the Bills did not need their passing game, but they do not have a functional aerial attack right now, and that seems utterly insane given how explosive they have been for most of the previous 6 years. Those days are gone, at least until Brandon Bean can address the wide receiver position in a meaningful way. Josh Allen is almost helpless when he drops back to pass because there's nowhere to go with the ball. The entire passing attack is predicated on throws made no further than 5 yards downfield, with many of his attempts being caught behind the line of scrimmage. Luckily for the Bills, they didn't need any help via the pass because they were so dominant in the run game. Allen finished 15 of 23 for just 123 yards with an interception and a touchdown. His wide receivers caught 5 passes for a grand total of 32 yards. James Cook, Dawson Knox, and Ty Johnson all caught 3 passes, which totaled 81 yards. The only positive was that Allen was not sacked, even though the Bills had to play without both their stud offensive tackles, Deion Dawkins and Spencer Brown. The run offense, a plus. Cook had another tremendous game. Yes, he had a damaging fumble in the first half that gave the Steelers a short field at the Bills' 39, and they capitalized for their only score of the game. But otherwise, Cook was Buffalo's only threat on offense. He soared past 100 yards for the 7th time this season, the most such games for a Bills running back since LeSean McCoy had 7 in 2016. The franchise record is 11, set by O.J. Simpson in his 2003-yard 1973 season. Cook set a new career high for carries with 32, and he was able to bite off big chunks even with the patchwork offensive line. Alec Anderson, who had 2 brutal false start penalties, and fellow reserve Ryan Van Demark did a great job run blocking, along with the always strong interior of the Bills line. Ray Davis had some definite juice with limited opportunities, gaining 62 yards on just 9 carries. And Allen was also a little more active running the ball, sometimes on scrambles, but there were a couple designed run calls as well as he finished with 38 yards. This was the third time this season the Bills have topped 200 yards as a team, and their 249 yards was a season high. Pass defense, A. Joey Bosa has been frustrated by the fact that while he has been getting quarterback pressures, he has not been getting sacks. That changed on the first play of the second half when he trucked Aaron Rodgers and forced a fumble that Christian Benford scooped and scored on to give the Bills a 10-7 lead. It was Bosa's 5th forced fumble of the season, tying the Bills' franchise record, most recently achieved by Aaron Schobel in 2007. And then a few plays after the kickoff, Benford picked off Mason Rudolph, who had replaced Rodgers, who was in the medical tent with a bloody nose, at the Buffalo 44, and the Bills went on to drive to a touchdown for a 16-17 lead. Benford was great all day as he traveled with Pittsburgh's lone wide receiver threat, DK Metcalf, and held him to 3 catches for 32 yards. Rodgers finished just 10 of 21 for 117 yards as the Steelers had the ball for just 18 minutes, accruing 10 first downs and 166 total yards. Run defense, A. The Steelers never got anything going on the ground, and that crippled their offense because their passing game is worse than Buffalo's. Of course, when you have the ball for as little as Pittsburgh did, there isn't much time to get any type of rhythm. Because of the inability to get into favorable third down situations, the Steelers went just 3-for-9 plus, went 0-for-1 on fourth down. Jaylen Warren and Kenneth Gainwell totaled just 55 yards, and the Steelers averaged only 3.2 yards per attempt, as the Bills' front seven was tremendous. Shaq Thompson, starting in place of injured Terrell Bernard, was a hammer in the run game, and he finished with a team-high 9 tackles, while the safeties Cole Bishop and Jordan Poyer combined for 9 tackles. Special teams, C. Sam Franklin committed a holding penalty on a first-quarter punt that created lousy field positions at the Bills' 13. Punter Mitch Wisnowski had his first touchback with the Bills, which resulted in a poor net of 27 yards in the first quarter, and kicker Matt Prater missed an extra point for the second game in a row, so it was not great in any way. The Bills made an interesting choice on the Steelers' first extra point. There was a 15-yard penalty against Pittsburgh, so the Bills could have pushed the PAT back to the 47 or taken the yards on the kickoff. Chris Boswell is a great kicker, but there was some wind to contend with. However, they took it on the kickoff, but under the new kickoff rules, the covering players are still lined up in the same spot. So it actually made a good return harder to accomplish, and Ray Davis gained only 14 yards to the 31. There were only two kickoff returns, and they totaled a mere 36 yards, one each by Davis and Ty Johnson. There were no punt returns, just three fair catches by Shakir. Coaching, B. The sequence at the end of the first half was kind of a mess. The Bills were in a 4th-and-3 at the Steelers' 4 with 55 seconds left. The right call would have been to kick the field goal, and then they had three timeouts to use. A defensive stop may have gotten the ball back for the offense for a potential field goal. Instead, the Bills decided to draw the Steelers offside to get closer, and when it didn't work, McDermott called a timeout. Then he decided to go for the touchdown again, but this time Connor McGovern false started, so only then did they kick. However, with only two timeouts, they couldn't get the ball back, and the half ended quietly. In the fourth quarter, the Bills took a 22-7 lead, and for some reason, McDermott did not go for two to make it a three-possession game. Joe Brady's creativity in the passing game is gone, neutered by the lack of weapons he has. Still, there had to be a way to get someone open more than 5 yards beyond the line of scrimmage. It wasn't necessary in this game because the running game was so dominant, but the problems are mounting. The Steelers are terrible on offense, but that doesn't detract from the great job Bobby Babich's unit did. Through three quarters, the Steelers had only one possession where they achieved more than one first down, and that one came when the defense was put in bad field position after Cook's fumble. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Tuesday, December 2nd issue of the Canandaigua Daily Messenger. Your reader has been Lori. Thank you for listening.